Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reeder, and my guest today has had a number of important, interesting, and varied careers all in one life. I'll just summarize here. Marc Garneau is a member of the Canadian Parliament and the Minister of Transport. But prior to that, he's been the Chancellor of Carleton University, the President of Canada's Space Agency, an astronaut and the first Canadian to go into space, and an officer in the Royal Canadian Navy. His nation has recognized his service with the Order of Canada. Transport Minister Garneau, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Grant.
So you have, as I just mentioned, such a rich and varied background. So what I'm going to try to do is cover the waterfront here. There's so many questions I'd like to ask you, and I'm going to dip into several areas of your experience and expertise. So let me start with space, if I could. Could you just very briefly for our listeners describe the missions that you had in space?
So I had the privilege of going on three missions. The first was aboard the Challenger in 1984, and it was a mission to observe the Earth. It was called 41G. And then I stayed with the program, and 12 years later, in 1996, I went on a mission called STS-77, which had a number of different tasks associated with it. We deployed an inflatable antenna, which was quite spectacular, because they were looking at the possibility of inflatable structures in space, the advantage being that they're much lighter to bring up into space. Mm. And I also, I was the arm operator on that mission, and I recovered a satellite called Spartan, which had been developed by the Goddard Space Center in the United States. And then my third mission was STS-97 in the year 2000, and we were building the International Space Station at that point, and we brought up on our flight in the payload bay the very first solar panels. You may have seen the space station. It has sort of four pairs of wings. Mm-hmm. The first pair of wings were brought up on our mission, STS-97. So it was an International Space Station construction mission.
And astronauts who have been in space have often talked about epiphanies that they have up there. And I was wondering if you had a most lasting impression of being in space that has stuck with you, or whether you might have learned something new about yourself by being up there.
Well, it is an intense experience, I would say, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually for some people. I think what stays with me all these years after my flying is the fact that I saw planet Earth from a unique perspective. It only takes 90 minutes to go around the planet when you're at orbital velocity in the space shuttle. And when you look out the window and you look down on our planet, which is beautiful, but at the same time you're very conscious of its fragility. If you look at the atmosphere, which is so thin, or the oceans, and the fact that there are 7.5 billion people here on the planet, you become conscious of the fact, as you see the blackness of space, that this is our home. It's our only home. There's 200 countries down there. We've got to find a way to get along with each other. And we also have to take care of the environment for the future. Those are the things that really stay with you from that experience.
Now, President Trump in the United States has called for a space force. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's my understanding of it is that it doesn't necessarily mean a lot of new initiatives. It's perhaps just sort of affirming the fact that there are elements of the space program in the United States that are focused on sovereignty and defense and national interests, and those are, I think, already pretty much in place. So I think it's really, in a sense, formalizing something that already exists.
Hmm. And I wanted to get your sense, too, of where you think space exploration is going, could go, say, over the next 20 to 30 years, because there's different conversations about that going on right now, and some of them are quite ambitious. So where do you think we're likely headed?
I think there are three important facets to space exploration. One is the, if you like, the astronomer's perspective, and we're becoming better and better at, even though we are limited with our tools, at postulating the presence of planets in other solar systems within our galaxy that may have the conditions necessary to sustain life, even though we can't directly see them. We infer indirectly about them depending on a number of factors. That's one thing, and I think we're getting better at that, and that's a tantalizing possibility. The second thing is we're going into space to look back at Earth. We realize with all the changes occurring on the planet that we need to pay more careful attention by Earth observation. And so I think that is a growing field. We already have GPS satellites. We have communication satellites. We have weather satellites up there. And they all make our life easier down here on Earth. But we also want to monitor what's happening with climate change and what have you. And the third is that, if you like, that human dimension of wanting to go out into our universe, and we're just in our backyard at the moment. But I think, in the years to come, in the decades to come, there is the possibility that an international crew will go to an asteroid or will go to Mars and indeed start off by going back to the moon. So that continues with the technologies that we have at our disposal at the moment. And I think those are the three areas where we will focus.
Just one quick follow-up on that. You mentioned the moon, and that was something that I had in my mind. It seems to me, not being the expert, that, we got to the moon and then we kind of left it alone. Why is that, and is there a value in putting humans back on it again?
Well, if we remember President Kennedy's famous speech at Rice University, challenging Americans and who rose to the challenge of getting to the moon, I think we have to admit that a lot of it was driven by the fact that there was a race going on between the United States and the Soviet Union, which had at that point appeared to take the lead. So I think the motivation for getting to the moon was to clearly give a strong boost to the space program in the United States and to show who was the best. Today, the motivation is different. It would be to go back there to do science or to use it as a staging ground to develop the technologies that would be necessary for going to Mars or to an asteroid, which are much further away.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Canadian Transport Minister and Member of Parliament in Canada, Mark Garneau. Okay, let's shift to borders and trade. And most of the political controversy here in the United States over our borders has concerned Mexico, not Canada, but the trade controversies certainly have included Canada. And those politics have become at times very sharply edged between the United States and the rest of the world. What are the most important things that you think Americans need to know about Canada when they're listening to American politicians talk about trade?
That's a very good question. Just to step back a little bit, Canada and the United States developed a free trade agreement back in the 80s. And in the 90s, we brought in Mexico with what we call NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And after 20 years, we decided we should renegotiate it. And that has been very much in the news for the past year and a half. And we have signed it. What perhaps American listeners may not be as fully aware of is that no two countries trade more than Canada and the United States on the planet. The 2018 figures, and these come from the United States, are that the trade between Canada and the U.S. in 2018 was $721 billion. That's virtually $2 billion every day of trade between Canada and the United States. And if you look at the goods and services that are traded between the two countries, in 2018, there was no deficit and no surplus. There was a very small surplus in the favor of the United States of $1.6 billion. But on $721 million, that's virtually in the noise level. So we export to the United States a little bit more in goods, but you bring to us a little bit more in services, and it roughly balances out. So it's a very good arrangement for both countries. And more than 30 states, in terms of where they export their products, Canada is the number one destination. There are 9 million Americans who work directly in industries and services whose focus is exporting to Canada or providing services to Canada. So it's a very big and very important trading arrangement. It's really the biggest in the world. And, of course, now with NAFTA, when we bring in Mexico, we're talking about 480 million people and a $22 trillion economy for those three countries. So trade between us is extremely important, and I'm glad to say 98% of it is tariff-free. And it has been a good working arrangement. And the other perhaps last part is that our two economies are tightly integrated in terms of supply chains. So it's a good deal for everybody, and we have to make sure that we continue that way.
It almost sounds like you're really describing one economy almost.
Almost.
In the way that they're integrated.
Absolutely.
Now, President Trump has recently threatened tariffs against Mexico if the movement of drugs across the border is not reduced. There was a prior threat of closing down the border. That's shifted now to, okay, I'm going to give you a one-year extension, but we've got to do something about these drugs crossing the border. Do you think the tariff threat is an effective tool of leverage for that problem?
Well, the contradiction is that when you're talking about a free trade agreement between three countries in this case, when you impose tariffs, you're putting in place protectionist measures. And Canada has difficulty with the tariffs that the United States has placed on aluminum and steel. And we've been very clear on that. Here we have this great new treaty that we've all signed. None of us have ratified it yet. But in the meantime, the United States is slapping a 25% tariff on Canadian steel and 10% on aluminum, which goes against the principle of free trade. And in this case, it's invoked by a clause called Section 32, which deems Canadian steel and aluminum to be a threat to American national security. Mm-hmm. Frankly, we don't accept that at all. In fact, it's absurd. The United States has a surplus in terms of sale of steel to us. Yes, we provide you with more aluminum. We've been doing this for a very long time, and it's worked very well. So we don't accept the use of tariffs. If you're going to have a free trade agreement, that's not to say you don't have disputes once in a while, but to put large tariffs like that seems to be contradictory with the idea of free trade.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest is Mark Garneau. He's Canada's transport minister, a member of its parliament, and a former astronaut. All right, now we're going to shift again. We're going to shift to transport. Your actual portfolio, as it's more narrowly defined, and your portfolio includes air safety, as I understand.
Indeed.
So I have a question about the Boeing 737 MAX safety issue. The issues surrounding the grounding of those jets, I think, have been pretty thoroughly covered in the media. And I wanted to ask you a different kind of question that I haven't heard talked about and I'm very curious about. Let's assume that these planes are eventually recertified. It's my sense as a non-expert that that will happen eventually. It might take a while. And then passengers are going to have to get back on those planes after all of this press attention and the two crashes. How should that be handled? I imagine that the first passengers on those planes are going to get a lot of media scrutiny, be interviewed as they're getting on. It could be kind of a difficult, tense situation, I think, for the public.
Yes, indeed. I think the public's confidence has been shaken by the fact that there have been two apparently similar causes to accidents, one with Lion Air in Indonesia, the other one with Ethiopian Airlines. And I think it is critically important that before they fly again, that Canadians and people from all countries that fly on the MAX 8 have 100% confidence that the problem has been addressed. So how we communicate that is going to be critical, not only how we ourselves review perhaps procedures and things that we did in the past to make sure that we're not missing something, and specifically very carefully look at the proposed modifications, but how we convey to the public that we have looked at this. We are 100% confident that we have resolved the issue that caused these two accidents to occur. I think that is what's going to help people become confident, in other words, to get back on the airplanes.
Would there be a tendency, do you think, of countries like the United States, perhaps Canada, to kind of wait and let other countries put people on these planes first and say, look, they've been, you know, they've been flying in Africa and there hasn't been an accident, and so let someone else go first?
Well, that's a very good point, and I think it will play into the perception that people will have. If they see one country say, okay, we've solved the problem, and they get back to flying, and they at the same time hear about other countries saying, we're not quite ready to do this yet, we haven't satisfied ourselves, then that will not help to reassure. So I think that in many ways, although there hasn't been any formal discussions between countries that have the MAX 8, I think that it is probably advantageous for us all to agree that we have the solution and all pretty much, perhaps not on the same day, but close to each other, resume the flights.
So a question about transportation infrastructure right now. This is a big topic in the United States, and it's a big topic nationally, but it's also a big topic in this area around Syracuse. What is, briefly, the state of Canada's infrastructure? Healthy? Problematic?
It is, I would say, relatively healthy, but it could be better. And we in Canada, our government is investing very heavily in infrastructure for a number of different areas. So what we call public transit infrastructure, as well as what we call green infrastructure, and record amounts of money for Canada, unprecedented amounts of money. Also, in my field of transportation, because we regard transportation as really an economic portfolio, and because we're the second largest country on earth, and because we're a trading nation, it is critically important for us to be able to move our goods efficiently. If we have clients in other countries, unless we get our goods to them reliably, on time, efficiently, then they'll turn to other customers. And so we have a special fund in Transport Canada called the National Trade Corridors Fund, which is trying to optimize our trade corridors so that we have less bottlenecks or other things that slow down the movement of goods. So we're putting a great deal of emphasis on that. A lot of it is by train, but also roads, because we have tens of thousands of trucks, for example, to the United States every day. There are tens of thousands of trucks that cross the border, thousands of rail cars that cross the border into the United States or go across our country to our Asia-Pacific Gateway, which is in Vancouver, or up the St. Lawrence and out to Europe and other parts of the planet. If we don't make them efficient, then we're not deriving the best possible outcome for our economy.
So the politics about infrastructure in the United States, I guess like every other aspect of the politics in the United States right now, has been pretty sharp-edged as well. Do you have any advice for us to get a better approach toward these political discussions?
Well, President Trump has identified infrastructure as being important. And when I speak to my counterpart, which is Secretary Elaine Chao, who's the Department of Transport, but also infrastructure, it's clear the United States very much recognizes the importance of infrastructure. And I think is also investing heavily in that. And we watch particularly the international infrastructure that crosses our border. For example, in Windsor, Detroit, which is a very important crossing point, we are actually building a Canadian bridge to supplement the existing Ambassador Bridge. It's called the Gordie Howe Bridge because we feel that the infrastructure that gets the goods from our country to yours or the other direction also has to be very efficient.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Canadian Transport Minister Mark Garneau. Shift to Canadian politics now. And to start, a very general question about this, if you could just give our listeners a brief sense of this. In terms that an American citizen could relate to, where has Canada's politics been trending over recent years?
Well, under our government, which has been the government for the past 3.5 years, we feel that it
is... And the Liberal Party.
The Liberal Party of Canada, yes. Our Prime Minister and our party believes it's very important that be a country that shows clearly that it lives by the rule of law, that it's a country that, being a fortunate country, can help other countries with not only aid, but also by speaking of and showing its policies and how it conducts itself, by being open to immigration, which is extremely important for Canada because we're a small country. We're about a tenth of the size of the United States in terms of population and economy, and we need immigrants, by being open to immigration, by being a moderate voice against the tendency for, there is a sort of a populist, nativist, right-wing tendency in the world, and we want to counter that. And I think it's very important for a country like Canada to be a country that demonstrates that the best approach is a moderate and more consensual approach.
Now, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, the leader of your party in Parliament, is currently embroiled in a scandal, and he's recently expelled from the party caucus and therefore their ability to run in the upcoming general elections in October. Two prominent women, former ministers, who made accusations of political meddling into a potential bribery case on behalf of a large Canadian company. I hope I've described that sufficiently objectively. My question to you is, how much has this damaged his leadership of the country?
It's certainly become a distraction. There's no question about it. We maintain that there has not been undue interference. It concerns the person who was what we call the Attorney General, and there's a difference of opinion on that. And it has to do with a particular case that is in the courts. And so a difference of opinion, but it has become polarized to some extent, and we have to deal with that. And but we maintain that we have taken the right approach, and Canadians will ultimately judge us. We have an election coming up in October, so Parliament will sit till June, and we continue in the meantime doing what we have promised to do for Canadians with respect to the economy, and we will deal with that. And ultimately, when the election comes up in October, Canadians will decide.
I had a question I wanted to put to you about that, but I'm going to throw another kind of strange one in first. Has it helped your party at all that you have a pretty significant sideshow going on south of the border in the United States to say, well, okay, we've got this issue, but look what's going on down there?
I would say that in the grand scheme of things, things are going well in Canada. We have record employment. We have created 900,000 jobs in the past 3 years. For a country the size of Canada, which has 37 million, that's significant. Lowest unemployment in 40 years. And so when all is said and done, things are going well in Canada. The United States has been a close partner and friend and ally for a very, very long time, and will continue to be so. We have such important economic interests. We talked about trade, but also security interests. We're the two members of NORAD. We are members of NATO. We're culturally very close to each other. And although each administration does things differently, we will continue to remain steadfast friends and partners, because not only do we like each other, we depend on each other.
Got a couple minutes left, but I want to squeeze at least two things in. One last thing on politics here. I've been looking at the national polls in Canada, and it does seem like there has been a recent flip in favor of the Conservative Party during 2019. Does this worry you?
I think that the issue that you spoke about a minute ago has had an effect on us in the polls. I think that my prediction is that when we move into the summer and fall and into the election, Canadians will once again fully focus on what is most important to the individual Canadian. Do I have a job? Do I have a security? What does the future look like? What's being done if I'm a senior to help me? We just released our 2019 budget, which has a great many measures for seniors, for young people, for students. We're looking at a what we call a pharmacare, which is a drug program for the entire country. Those are the issues that will matter to Canadians when the election comes up, and I think the issue that currently is a distraction will have faded.
So in just about a minute and a half or so, I wanted to get you to reflect on something. I'm going to throw you something here from out of left field. But you have, I think I've got this title right, and if I do have it right, then you do have, I think, the coolest formal title of anyone who's been on this program during the last 10 years. If I understand correctly, you are known formally as Captain the Honorable Mark Garneau. Is that correct?
Well, sometimes, yes, indeed. I was a captain in the Navy, and being a member of what we call the Privy Council as a minister, I have the right to, and I'm addressed as the Honorable Mark Garneau, yes.
So what is it like? I mean, that almost sounds like a title out of a Marvel comic movie. You know, you should be part of the Avengers or something. So what's it like walking around with that?
It's obviously I'm very proud of it, but it's also an extremely important responsibility. There's a lot put on your shoulders, and you have to live up to that title and to how you have been recognized. And so I feel continuously the pressure to live up to people's expectations. I did when I was an astronaut, and I do as a politician.
I notice you're wearing the Order of Canada pin on your lapel there.
Yes, and that's a great honor, and it is something that I'm extremely proud of, and the order encourages us to wear them.
That was Mark Garneau, Captain the Honorable Garneau. It's been a real pleasure and a thrill to have you on the program. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
It was a pleasure, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.